Colonel Walton, Reel 2. Did you have any special training for being called out in aid of the civil power in India?
Oh, yes. I think that is one of the chief duties of the army in India. Particularly, I think, British regiments, because they have no leanings towards either Hindu or Muslim. They're neutral, whereas an Indian regiment, the company or squadron, might be a Hindu one or it might be a Muslim one, and then they would naturally have sympathy with one side or the other. And most of the civil trouble in India was communal, that is to say, Hindu versus Muslim.
What did the training consist of?
Well, we were there kept out of sight while the police were dealing with the trouble. When the police felt it's entirely their decision, I should say, rather than the police, the civil, because the in which I include the police, but a civil government officer, a commissioner or a collector or someone, would have to be there before the army could be called on. And when he thought, on police advice, that the police could no longer handle it, the trouble had got too large, he called the army in. And there was one really strong point which we were always told, that the civil officer cannot say, bring your men in and open fire. The only person who can order the troops to open fire is the officer in charge of the troops. That is entirely his responsibility. If he thinks it's necessary to open fire, he opens fire. You can't open fire on the order of the civil official. He can hand over to you, and I think I'm right in saying he had to give you a signed thing to say that he handed the position over to you, and from then on it was the officer in command of the troops' responsibility, which to my mind was putting a rather unfair responsibility onto very often a young officer.
What did the officers feel about this business of being called out in aid of the civil power?
Well, throughout the world, as you can see in Ireland at the moment, it's about the most unpopular thing you can do, because whatever you do, you're almost certain to be wrong. Or almost certain to be told you're wrong. But it's one of the things that was accepted. It had to be done. But generally speaking, from my personal experience, it was very seldom necessary to fire. Occasionally, fire one shot, and that was usually enough. The orders also were, you don't fire a volley into the crowd. You pick out one man who was obviously a ringleader. He mightn't be in front. In fact, most ringleaders are not in front. They find it safer to lead from the back. And if you could pick him out, pick out your best shot and say, shoot that man. And that would probably stop the trouble.
When can you name the instances when you were called out?
Let me try and think, Ruth. I think there was a case in St. Thomas's Mount where one section of the community, which it was, had offended the other by, if they were Hindus, they'd gone near the Muslim place of worship or vice versa. And they started a slight fracas there. Now, in St. Thomas's Mount, there was a very small police force, and they very soon found that the crowd was out of hand and required to be silenced or quietened. And that was one instance I remember. It didn't take long. When we were called in, I think about half an hour after, the crowd dispersed in their various directions, and then we and the police patrolled around the area for a short time afterwards. But I don't remember any big communal rioting, which there were in parts of India, I know, but I wasn't actually there.
St. Thomas's Mount is just outside Madras.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Were you called out in the north?
We must have been called out in Meerut, I think, but I can't really remember it. When I had a staff appointment in Lucknow, I remember troops being called out in Cawnpore on several occasions. I wasn't actually there when there was trouble, but Cawnpore is one of the trouble centres where the population is about 50-50 Hindu Muslim, and that always sparks off trouble.
Were any of the troops ever injured in any of these instances?
Occasionally, yes. Usually not seriously. Most of the mobs were not armed, and they weren't anti the troops. Occasionally a brick or a bottle or something was thrown at the troops, but you all wore these topis, either the old cork one or the pith helmet, and they were fairly, they're like a policeman's helmet. They stop anything of that sort. It's only if you aren't looking and you catch it in the face.
Did you have any special training for frontier warfare?
Yes. When we knew we were going up there, we, I don't know whether it was the brigadier or the commanding officer, he arranged for an officer with experience of the front to come and stay with the regiment and give lectures and demonstrations and things, and we got us lots of pamphlets about it and the sort of form that it was. Again, you don't really learn it until you're up there, because you can't learn from a book in the same way that you can actually on the ground.
The training that you received in India was mainly for internal duties, of course.
Yes. Of course, when the war started, a lot of Indian divisions went to the Middle East to start with, and then also to Burma as well.
Do you think that the training, the character of the training in India, since a lot of it was for actual Indian conditions, internal Indian conditions, do you think the nature of that training at all limited your effectiveness when it came to the Second World War and you were engaged against major powers?
No, I don't think so, because I think a lot of the where British regiments were concerned, the battalion in India was always kept up to strength. It was one of the agreements with the Indian government, at the expense of the battalion at home. So the battalion at home might be almost 50% under strength, and when it was made up with recruits from the depot with no experience at all, and only basic training. And therefore the foreign battalion was always more efficient than the home one, because for one thing it was always up to strength and with older and more experienced men.
Did you have any joint training exercises with the RAF?
Oh yes. No, there was no airdrop or parachute drop or anything like that I can remember in those days. But we always had the exercises with them where, if you were attacking a position, they gave you support in front of your forward troops and that sort of thing. Probably only dropping smoke bombs or something of that sort. But
was this at Meerut?
Yes, I think Meerut would be the most likely, because that's where we did the most large-scale training.
How useful did you find this training with the RAF?
Very useful, but again, it isn't the real thing, and you learn by experience. I mean, you know, if you get a bit too close to your RAF support, and they're only dropping bags of flour, it won't do you much harm, but you find out it's rather different if they're actually dropping real stuff.
How much cooperation was there with the Indian Army?
Oh, a lot. We worked almost entirely with them. The general Indian Brigade was made up of three Indian regiments and one British. That is an inheritance of the mutiny, where there was always one in four British troops in an area.
How did the British soldier get on with the Indian soldier?
Very well, as a rule. How, I don't know, because the British soldier picks up the language of a sort of language of the country, but whether the Indian troops really understood it or not, I don't know. But you could see them in frontier camps sitting around a fire, chatting what they were talking about. But I couldn't tell, but they were. There was no doubt about that.
Were there Indian officers at the, for you to mix with whilst you were in India?
Yes, there are two types of Indian officer. There's the Viceroy's commissioned officer, who in the British Army would be a warrant officer, that's a sergeant major. They were normally the platoon commanders. And then there's the King's commissioned Indian officer, who had probably been to Sandhurst. He was an Indian with a King's commission, and well, King's it was in those days. Exactly the same as us.
And how much contact did you have with the Indian King's commissioned officer?
Just as much as you did. I mean, if you had the Warwickshire regiment next door to you, you'd have their officers in your mess, and if the Baluch regiment were on the other side, their officers would come in exactly the same.
So you mixed freely in the mess?
Oh yes. That was one of the instructions, that you went to treat them as a lower class person, if you know what I mean, which is rather the tendency, I think, for anyone going out to start with. He's inclined to think that all coloured people are coolies anyhow, and so on. Well, they have to learn that.
What was your impression of the Indian King's commissioned officers?
Oh, generally very good, but my impression of the Viceroy's commissioned officers couldn't be higher. They were a marvellous type, like, as you might, I'd say, anyone in the British Army who gets to the rank of warrant officer is also, and so it's the same thing.
What was so good about them?
Well, they understood the Indian troops extremely well. They knew the country, and they were that they'd come up from the ranks and they knew every trick that the private soldier might try on the platoon commander, whereas a British officer coming out from Sandhurst doesn't know that. He has to learn the hard way.
What type of tricks are you referring to?
Well, you know, all sort of things, like trying to scrounge out of guard duty or anything of that sort. I mean, an Indian troop would no more try and persuade a VCO that he was too sick to go on guard if he wasn't, whereas he might try it on his British counterpart.
Were there any instances of conflict or rivalry between the British troops and the Indian troops?
Well, there were in certain areas. I fortunately was never in an area where there was, but it's difficult to attribute blame on either of those cases. There were probably faults on both sides, but there are only incidents that I'd heard of and had no personal experience of them.
Can you tell me about any of the personalities which you might like to refer to, whom you met in India?
Yes, there was my brigadier in India, whose name was Freeland. He was a very experienced, in Rosmak, I mean, on the front. He was a very experienced frontier soldier, and we learnt a lot from him. The Baluch regiment, I think, used to recruit Pathans, and so he understood the mentality of the frontiersmen, the tribesmen, as they were normally called.
I think you also said that you met Mountbatten.
Yes, not in India, that was in Burma. Oh yes, he impressed me enormously. We were training at a camp in the, I think, in the Arakan when he came to inspect us, and he arrived. He was supposed to meet the brigade commander somewhere and then be brought along to us. And after breakfast, however, somehow lost the way and arrived straight up in our camp outside the mess. And someone came and shouted to me and said, "Mountbatten's out here." Well, I was just, he was about an hour before we expected him. I think, as a matter of fact, I was eating my breakfast. And so I rushed out, and there he was. And he said, "Oh, I'm awfully sorry. I seem to have made a mistake, come to the wrong place at the wrong time." I said, if you will wait, if you come at the mess a moment, so the I'll send for the brigadier. Brigade headquarters is only about a mile down the thing. And he said, "Oh, that's a good idea." And when he got in the mess, I said, "Would you care for some breakfast or a cup of coffee?" And he said, "You know, you wouldn't have a brandy and ginger ale, would you?"
Did he get one?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think he'd had a rather tiring, trying flight to get there.
What was your opinion of Mountbatten?
Oh, first class. He had great personality. He, troops all thought the same, I'm sure, both British and Indian troops. When he, after his drink, we had the battalion formed round, and he said he wanted to, you know, just talk to them a bit, and they were formed up in three sides of a square, and he and the brigadier walked out to a little rostrum where he was going to stand up, and he looked round and said, "Oh, some of you chaps who can't hear out there, come round and sit on the ground round me." And of course they all rushed up to him.
Were you engaged in any operations on the frontier?
Yes, the first time we went up from Mimir, we went up particularly for the... it may have had another name, but we always call it the Champlain operation. And we went up there to reinforce the troops that were up there, and remained there for... Well, the operation actually only took a few months, and we rather expected to return to Meerut, but it was then changed, and we were sent up to Razmak to do a tour up there.
What was the object of the Champlain operation?
I'm not quite sure. I think it was to clear an area of hostile tribesmen who were making trouble with the local inhabitants and that sort of thing. And the presence of troops there was largely to stop them trying anything on.
What were your own duties?
We went into this camp, which I think was called Garryome, I think it was. It was a brigade camp, and you know, the usual camp pickets around the camp, and troops went out each day to search and scour a certain area. Got rather boring after a bit.
Did you come under fire?
Occasionally, yes. Never any, not real fire, because it was only sniping, if you know what I mean. I mean, you weren't up against German Mark III and Mark IV tanks or anything of that sort.
How did you find the shooting of the Pathans?
Well, the general thing one hears, or rather we heard into before you went into the frontier, was this marvellous shooting of the hostile tribesman, as he was called. Well, that I think is an absolute myth, because occasionally we shot and killed a few, and we got their rifles. Well, the sort of condition their rifles were in, they weren't capable of hitting a barn door to 100 yards. Actually, as a man at 1,000 yards or something, which they were supposed to be able to. There may have been the odd good shot amongst them who had a good rifle, but any of the ones that we saw were in such poor condition that they couldn't possibly shot accurately. Added to which, if you're shooting at a column from a hill, column which is moving along the valley, it's fairly easy to hit something, even if it isn't what you aimed at, because they're so closely packed in the valley you can hardly miss.
Were you ever engaged in any operations pursuing the Fakir of Ypres?
Yes, I was trying to think where we went from for that. Yes, we chased him up to the Afghan border, and there were various camps on the way. It was an extremely tiring and rather thirsty journey because it's rather a waterless area up there. But there was not a lot of resistance from his followers.
So you never caught up with him?
No. We caught up with one of his camps and found cooking fires and things still burning, which meant he'd only left a matter of hours before. Most of that operation, I think, was carried out by the RAF because they could move so much easily over that mountainous country than we could. And if his retreating followers were scuttling over the mountains, the RAF might be able to dig them out, you know, machine gun them if they could see them. But it isn't all that easy in that mountainous area to see the odd men. I mean, after all, they aren't in brigades or anything. They're the odd man on his own, scattered.
Did the British forces take any casualties on the frontier whilst you were there?
Yes, comparatively small. We had an officer shot on that chasing Epi. He was walking up to a conference, actually, and there was pickets were out in front, but there was the odd sniper who hadn't been spotted, and he just took a shot at the officers who were walking along, and he shot this one. He might, I'd have shot anyone, the CO or the brigadier or anyone else, but it was, to my mind, a rather careless way of moving out from the camp pickets before they were absolutely certain that the area was clear.
So was he killed or wounded?
Killed instantly. He was shot straight in the chest.
And the bodies were buried on the spot, were they?
That I can't remember. I think normally we'd try and get them back to the nearest cantonment.
What did you think of the Pathans you were fighting?
Oh, I like the Pathan. He's the best of the Indian or Pakistani or whatever you like to call it. He's very fair-skinned. If he came to England, he could almost pass as an Englishman. I mean,
what was there about the Pathans that you liked?
Well, they are 100% honest, I think. I had a Pathan servant at one time, and you know, I mean, if they tell you something, it's true, which you can't always take from the other Indians I've found. Mind you, I'm talking from outside, from within the Indian Army. If you talk to an officer of the Indian Army whose regiment were Sikhs, he would say that the Sikh is the best soldier of the world. If you, you know, or Gurkhas or whatever it is. But I'm talking from the outside. I like the Pathan best, and after that, the PM, the Punjabi Usulman, he's very much similar to the Pathan. And generally speaking, I would say he's the best all-round Indian soldier there is. I mean, he may not have the flair and dash of the Sikh, or the stubborn resistance of the Gurkha, but I think generally